This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Rebecca Lerner. Becky is an urban forager, an independent nature educator and healer, and a former newspaper journalist. Through teaching, speaking, and writing about the useful wild plants of Portland, Oregon, she seeks to inspire and empower fellow human beings to remember that we are part of nature, not separate from it. Becky Lerner is here today to tell us about her book, Dandelion Hunter, Foraging the Urban Wilderness, published in 2013. Welcome, Becky.
Thanks so much, Diane.
What led you to write your book, Dandelion Hunter?
I wanted to find a way to share my experiences learning how to forage wild plants in my hometown of Portland, Oregon, in a way that would inspire, entertain, and empower my readers.
What do you mean by urban foraging?
That's a great question. If you were to Google that, you'd get a few different responses. Wikipedia would say that it has to do with dumpster diving, but that's not what I mean by it, and increasingly that's not what the media means by it. Today, urban foraging tends to refer more to harvesting wild plants within an urban metropolitan area.
What do you see as the value of urban foraging or being a forager?
Oh my, there's just such a tremendous amount of value in foraging. It's hard to know where to begin. Through foraging, I'm able to find lots of wonderful free food. I'm able to get herbal medicines that I can make for myself, my friends, even my dog, saving me lots of medical bills and expenses and enabling me and empowering me to be able to cure myself of many, many common ailments and others. And it's also a way for me to deepen my relationship with nature all around me so that I don't feel that I need to go into a traditional wilderness area such as the woods in order to feel close to nature. I have a much deeper respect for nature and a much deeper connection with nature because I can see plants everywhere, weeds, ornamental trees. Everywhere I look outside my apartment or anywhere in any city, I can find useful plants and I can feel a connection to them.
What are some examples of plants that grow wild in the city that can be used as food?
That's a great question. Fall is a really wonderful season to look for food in a city in particular, because there are so many chestnut trees, walnut trees, and of course fruit trees. I know we have lots of fig trees in Portland as well. And then in late summer, which will be coming up not too long from now, we'll also have blackberries, which are great for foraging. And many people are concerned about contamination when we talk about harvesting food in a city. And that's one of the good things, I think, about urban foraging, is that it inspires us to enhance our sense of stewardship of the land around us and become even more concerned and invested in making sure that we keep it clean and healthy. So I think it's a really good question and concern. The good news is that in the meantime, the research that I've seen shows that the reproductive parts of plants, meaning the fruit, the nut, and the flowers, tend to be the least contaminated. And so that means the best parts for foragers right now, which are the fruits and the nuts that we'll get in summer and fall, are the best and the cleanest.
Would you tell us about your project to survive for a week on only wild food in Portland, both your first and second attempts? Start with the first one. What was the challenge you agreed to?
Oh, thanks so much for this question. Yes, that was quite an adventure. The first time that I tried it, I was dared, basically, by an editor at a web magazine to see if I could live off of the wild plants within the Portland metro area for a week. And we agreed that this should be done in late May. And this was in 2009. And I documented what I was eating and where I was finding it and what it all tasted like on my blog and for this web magazine. And, you know, I had been learning about wild plants for only a few months at that point, really. And I was confident that I could identify a number of them, but I hadn't really tried much more than tasting them. And what I thought was, well, you know, the Pacific Northwest was a hub for hunter-gatherer cultures until very, very recently. And so if these people could live off of wild plants year-round in the same spot, surely I could do it for a week, right? But what I found out was that nature's not like the grocery store. And so what I found in late May was really just a few greens and some roots. And I became very lightheaded. And I found that I was foraging many, many hours a day, looking around for food, scouting, you know, and just I was exhausting myself and very stressed. And I didn't make it the whole way. And it was really a difficult decision for me to decide to stop. But I had made it about 5 days and I was at a point where I was going to black out and I had to stop. Because if I were to continue, I wasn't going to be able to actually look for food. I would have just been sitting in my apartment doing basically a hunger strike. And I thought, well, you know, either way, that's not success. So I'll have to try it again.
So what did you learn from that first attempt that helped you when you tried again?
I learned a lot of really important lessons. One of them was that wild food, you know, has different amounts of nutrition in it. And when we talk about foraging, a lot of times people think about greens, especially in the spring. But the most nutritious parts of wild food are actually the fruit and the nuts, and to an extent, some roots. And those are all really foods you find in the summer and the fall. So it became very important for me to do as the squirrels do and get out there and forage when those foods were available and then store them. And the other thing that I paid a lot of attention to is the fact that in hunter-gatherer cultures, community is very, very important. That social aspect of gathering is very, very important because it leads to greater efficiency, among other attributes. So the second time around, I made sure that I involved more friends in the gathering process and the processing process as well. And that made a really big difference.
So at the end of your successful attempt, you had a Thanksgiving dinner. Would you like to tell us about the dinner and what you had?
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, we had a Thanksgiving feast. It was wonderful. It was me and about half a dozen friends, and we each brought different foraged food items, and we made it an entirely wild feast. Someone brought roadkill venison, someone brought some cattail roots, and someone brought some wapato roots, which is a wild swamp potato, you could say, which we had all gone together in wetsuits and foraged for in a swamp. And I brought some chestnut flour, and we made, well, I don't know what we would call them, some kind of approximation of a biscuit with it. We made some things with chanterelle mushrooms. Someone actually brewed yarrow beer. We just had an amazing feast. I think the most exciting dish for me was actually rose hips. One of my friends, Emily, actually reduced a bunch of rose hips. She removed the seeds. She sliced the berries open and removed the seeds, and then she cooked them basically and reduced them down into something like a bright orange cranberry sauce, which tasted pretty similar, maybe even better. And it was wonderful.
Was it more difficult to prepare the wildly derived foods compared to other foods that you might get at the grocery store?
Definitely it was more difficult. We all had a lot less experience with it, and so we didn't really know how long to cook things for or what to mix in with, you know, each other, but we did our best. It was certainly very exciting. It was all super local. It was all very healthy and wild, and it was free, and that was all really cool.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Becky Lerner, author of the book Dandelion Hunter, Foraging the Urban Wilderness. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What is most difficult about surviving by urban foraging?
What is most difficult is finding the food, especially in a city like Portland or like Seattle. You know, you have different patches of food scattered all around the city. First of all, finding the different wild plants is difficult, but then actually getting them and gathering them takes a lot of time because you may be scattered all over the city trying to collect a bunch of berries here and a bunch of chestnuts 10 blocks away. And then, you know, you might have found some walnuts a mile from there. And so it can be really time consuming.
What do you find most satisfying about surviving by urban foraging?
I think the most exciting thing about using urban foraging as a survival strategy and tool is the empowerment that you get to feel from doing that. I think it's an amazing feeling to know that you don't need a farmer or even a gardener in order to survive.
What are some of the best foraging opportunities in a Northwest urban environment?
Oh, there are so many foraging opportunities in the Northwest. I mean, this has to be one of the best regions for foraging, or it wouldn't have sustained so many populations for thousands and thousands of years through foraging. It's amazing. I think in our forests, we can find a lot of native berries, which are wonderful, such as salmonberry and thimbleberry, and of course, huckleberry, and some less talked about berries that can be made into creative jams like Oregon grape. And in addition to that, we also have a lot of stinging nettle, and stinging nettle is a wonderful food. Of course, we have many mushrooms too, but I'm a big fan of stinging nettle. I've been doing a lot of stinging nettle quiche and stinging nettle pesto this season in particular.
How do you go about deciding where to forage?
Well, I certainly want to make sure that I feel the plants look clean to me and look robust. I go a lot by just common sense and intuition and looking around an area. I tend to forage in places that are convenient to me. I do it for fun. I do it as a supplement now and then. I like making neat foraged foods and especially foraged items that I can give friends or family as gifts, I think are a lot of fun. And so I tend to forage in areas that are near where I live or near where I tend to go often. So convenience is a big factor. And then cleanliness is another factor. So I'm paying attention to how do the plants look? Are they right next to the road? That's not really a problem for me if I'm talking about getting fruits or nuts or berries. But if I'm going to get greens like stinging nettle, I want to find them in the forest if I can, or a very shady yard that's tended by someone who can assure me that it's not sprayed with chemicals. So that's definitely a concern. And then sustainability is another concern. I want to be able to come back to that spot. And I also want to make sure that the other animals that might be using the plant in some way are not being impacted by me.
What senses do you use to identify plants?
A lot of people would think that the main sense you use is your eyesight. But it's actually the case that I use touch a lot too, as well as smell. And so a really good example of this would be wild carrot. Wild carrot looks quite a bit like poison hemlock, and it really does matter if you mix up the two, because you can die if you eat poison hemlock by accident. And if you were using only your visual senses, you really could make this mistake pretty easily. They really look quite similar. And they both do grow in the cities. And so they are very likely to be among the plants that you would come across as a forager. But the trick is, wild carrot has a hairy stalk. So if you touch the stalk and it's very fuzzy, you can rest assured you have found wild carrot. And further, once you pull it up, you'll see a taproot that looks a little like a carrot. It won't be orange if you find it wild. It'll be more beige, grayish even. And if you smell it, then it'll smell like carrot. So if you've got a hairy stalk and it smells like carrot and the root is a taproot, you've got wild carrot. But if you touch the stalk and it's smooth and maybe even leaves a little bit of powder on your fingertips, you found poison hemlock. And if you smell the roots and the roots don't smell quite like carrot, you might have found poison hemlock. And I also would use my visual sense a little bit with the roots too, because sometimes poison hemlock has a more diffuse root system as opposed to the taproot like carrot. But occasionally it can look a little like carrot. So that's why I'm going to use my fingers and my nose a whole lot.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but would you say more about how you take potential pollution into account? For example, issues with dogs and car exhaust.
Sure. Pollution is a really important issue for urban foragers to think about, to be aware of. And, you know, the dog question is probably the one that comes up the most often, which is funny. You know, urine is sterile, so you can simply wash anything that might have been peed on and you're fine. But you can also take a look and see what do the plants look like to your eye. Poop is much bigger of a concern because it's got bacteria in it, and that you can tell visually. But again, I don't really get greens right next to the road or the sidewalk if I can avoid it. I generally like to get the greens that I'm going to be foraging either from a neighbor's yard who said sure and who I know isn't spraying, or from an alleyway that's not traveled a lot by vehicles and is maybe more of a footpath, something like that would be a more ideal spot. And then as far as chemical contamination, you know, there are a lot of different concerns, and that's something that urban farmers have been thinking about a lot too. And the good news about those kinds of contaminations is that they can be cleaned up and contained. And so when we do find places that are contaminated, that's not a death sentence for that space. And I think the more of us that are interested in foraging and the more of us that see the potential in wild plants and wild spaces, the cleaner our cities will become.
We also have already alluded a bit to this, but would you say more about the possibility that too much urban foraging would lead to the elimination of the wild plants in a given urban area?
A lot of people also ask this question about sustainability, and I think it's a wonderful question because it shows that we're going in the direction of wanting to expand the wild. But I think that there's not enough foraging going on, and what tends to happen is that as people become interested in foraging, there's more of a pressure on expanding areas for foraging. So I think that would be really positive. I think we would end up talking about creating more things like what Seattle has here with the Beacon Hill Food Forest, creating more areas that are very forager friendly, talking about cleaning up areas that are not so forager friendly to become much more abundant resources for foraging. I think also that the impact of foraging is mitigated somewhat by the amount of time and energy it actually takes to forage. Foraging really is a hobby for almost everyone, or a supplement for even the most hardcore. In fact, even hunter-gatherers in, you know, obscure parts of the world, by and large, are not exclusively foraging their diets. They tend to do some trade with agricultural peoples, and that's just a function of efficiency. There's actually a guy in the UK named Fergus Drennan who goes by Fergus the Forager. And Fergus is currently trying to fund a project on Kickstarter that would allow him to be able to forage full time. And so that's the kind of thing people have to do, especially in urban environments, in order to be able to forage enough to create a huge impact. So at this point, I really see foraging as something that will ultimately save the wilderness and something that will help us expand the wilderness. I think what we saw earlier on in America in our history was this very rapacious attitude towards the wilderness that was very, very damaging. And then we saw a reaction to that, which was don't touch it. But the problem is that there are two sides of the same coin, because when we don't touch it, then it becomes something that doesn't have much utility to us and something that we don't have a strong argument for saving.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Becky Lerner, author of the book Dandelion Hunter, Foraging the Urban Wilderness. How much urban foraging is going on?
A surprising amount of urban foraging is going on, and it's happening all over the world. There are actually some anthropologists at the Institute for Culture and Ecology, which is here in the Pacific Northwest, who studied Seattle in particular. And they found that foragers were using no less than 433 different species of plants around here. So there's a whole lot of foraging happening, especially in Seattle and especially in Portland, too. And it's an increasing number. And the surprising thing is that folks might tend to think, oh, these foragers must be these Portlandia types, these quirky alternative weirdos, or these just super hardcore local food types. But actually, a lot of foragers are people who either grew up foraging because they came from rural backgrounds, or who came from other countries where foraging is just part of a cultural way of getting food and just a cultural tradition. So there's actually all kinds of foragers, and I tend to find that the people who are coming to my readings lately tend to be over 60, a whole lot of people. And those are not the people you see at Portlandia.
Would you speak about the legality of foraging?
Absolutely. So foraging does exist a little bit in a gray area. The laws vary state to state. Washington is much more permissive than Oregon is in terms of foraging in the state parks. In Washington, you can pretty much forage anything as long as you're doing it for personal use, non-commercially. In Oregon, the laws are much more restrictive, and they limit you pretty much to berries and mushrooms. And that's something that every individual has to make decisions about for themselves. Of course, the national forests are much more permissive than a lot of the state forests are. And then city rules for foraging vary from place to place. But the way that I look at it is a lot of what's in the city is a commons. And so places like alleyways that are overgrown, areas that are overreaching the sidewalk with fruit trees and nut trees, those are great opportunities for foraging, as are making relationships with your neighbors and others in your community who may have fruit trees that they are happy for you to harvest because they can't get to it, or who may have an overgrown lawn with just lots of wild plants, and they may say, oh, well, I don't want to spray it, but I don't have time to manage it. And so those make perfect fits for people who are interested in foraging.
When you've done your foraging, what kind of response have you gotten from people that have observed you doing it?
Only the most positive responses. No one has ever said anything negative. Some people are very aware of wild plants and their edibilities and uses, surprisingly so, and they may actually know what I'm foraging and relate a story of when they foraged it. Or sometimes people simply ask, what are you doing? And when I tell them, oh, yeah, I'm grabbing some dandelion leaves right now, I'm going to put them in some green smoothies. They're very detoxifying. People are really interested and excited about it. You know, I think many of us grow up as kids wanting to put everything in our mouths. That's one of those developmental stages. And we're told by the grown-ups, no, no, that's not safe. Only a few things are safe to put in your mouth. So I think when we learn then as adults, actually, you can put a lot of this stuff in your mouth. I think it's very liberating.
Would you say more about examples of wild urban plants that can be used as medicine?
Oh, yeah, that's wonderful. So in the Pacific Northwest, in Seattle and Portland, we see a lot of Oregon grape, and that's one of the most important medicinal plants that I use. Oregon grape is an antimicrobial. And so what I do is I actually make a tincture of the roots, but you could also make a tincture of the berries. And Oregon grape is a shrub that looks a little bit like holly, but holly is a tree, and holly has red berries, whereas Oregon grape is a shrub or a large bush, and it has blue berries, or bluish, very matte colored berries. And one of the active compounds in Oregon grape is berberine, and it's essentially an herbal antibiotic. And so you can use it when you get strep throat, you can use it for the flu, for colds, for actually things such as E. coli and Giardia it works for. You can use it externally on the skin for infections. So lots and lots of applications. And so what I do is I actually get the root of Oregon grape and I harvest it sustainably because they grow horizontally under the soil rhizomatically. And so you can actually clip, say, a foot-long section of this horizontally growing rootlet and a new plant will grow up from it. So you're not killing the plant you're harvesting from, which is really wonderful. I do try to make sure that where I harvest from, there's a large community of Oregon grape growing so that I'm not endangering the stand that I found. And I try to take 10% or less of the stand whenever I can at a time because I want to have a sustainable impact. But making a tincture is surprisingly simple. All I need to do is take those roots home, wash them, chop them up, and put them in a glass jar. And then I just fill the jar with those roots and I cover them halfway with the strongest alcohol I can find, which is usually a grain alcohol like Everclear or a generic. And then I fill the rest with water and I cover it and I put it in a dark cabinet for up to 6 weeks. And then I can take it out and use it. It's a brown liquid and you can put it in tea or you could apply it externally. Yeah, really useful.
How can someone make their neighborhood a great place to forage?
I think a neighborhood would be a great place to forage when there's lots of fruit and nut trees. So I think when we're talking about what should we plant, a very forageable neighborhood would have a lot of berry bushes, would have a lot of nut trees. You know, acorns are exciting, but I would say that the least useful wild edible nut that we can find. We have also hazelnuts here, and so hazelnuts would be great to plant too. Looking whenever possible at plants that naturally will thrive within this ecosystem and this climate is really wonderful too. So I would say looking at planting edibles would be making a neighborhood very forager friendly. Another thing we could do is consider limiting and banning perhaps the use of lawn chemicals because those contaminate forageable foods and medicines.
Would you give us a forager's thoughts on invasive species?
Oh, what a fun question. Invasive species, yes. So I think invasive species get a really bad rap, personally. I think people tend to become a little bit overzealous with that term and use it to incorrectly demonize many plants that are simply not native. And not every plant that isn't native is in some way harmful. Many plants that are not native will end up filling a niche in our local ecosystem without causing any harm, and in fact may even cause lots of benefits. So there are a few plants that are truly invasive in the sense of disrupting the balance of our local plants and our local ecosystems. And even those I think we can look at from a very positive perspective as extremely useful. And a good example of that would be blackberry. You can do so much with blackberry. Think about how much food that represents for people and the tremendous amount of hunger that we struggle with in the Northwest and in the inner cities. And think then about how much good we could do with all these berries. So I think looking at a lot of invasive species as assets as much as possible is really helpful and useful. And blackberry, too, is not only a food, but it is also a medicine. And so even the roots, if we were to dig them up, and the leaves could be used for medicinal teas.
What are some resources available for listeners who might be interested in urban foraging?
Oh, there are many wonderful books on urban foraging in terms of being able to find some great field guides. And I do have a list in the back of mine, but I'll list just a few of my favorite field guides. One of them is what a lot of foragers simply refer to as the POJAR. And what they mean by that is Plants of the Pacific Northwest Coast, which is a great field guide for native plants of the different wilderness areas we're going to find around here. And it's by POJAR and McKinnon. Another one is a book called Edible and Medicinal Plants of the West by Gregory Tilford. Those are all great books. I would mention also my website, which is firstways.com, and Ways is W-A-Y-S. And that's my blog where I actually take lots of photos of plants that I'm using and learning about and try to teach others how to use them and how to identify them. So that's a really great place to start if you're interested in foraging. And then there are some other really great websites and videos around the web too for those who are interested. And I think one of the best ways to learn about foraging if you're new to it is to go on a plant walk whenever you can. Go with someone who's sure of what everything is so you feel really confident that you're getting the right information. It can be very intimidating to try to identify something unfamiliar from a book. So I think it's great if you can go on a guided tour. And there are some guided tours offered by many folks all over the Northwest.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I have lots of big wishes for this book, for Dandelion Hunter. I hope overall it inspires folks to see that there's another way of relating to nature. We don't have to look at it as something that we're in charge of or that we need to control. I hope that Dandelion Hunter inspires folks to look at wild plants as holding lots of possibilities and resources for us.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Everyone can forage. It's not only for experts, and you absolutely can do it.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Becky.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great fun.
You were just listening to Becky Lerner, author of the book Dandelion Hunter, Foraging the Urban Wilderness, published in 2013 by Lions Press. For more information, check on the web at firstways.com. Again, that's firstways.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.